I'm Mark Labberton, president of Fuller Theological Seminary. Welcome to Conversing. My great pleasure today to welcome Dr. Cameron Lee as our guest on Conversing. Welcome, Cameron.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here.
Some of you who may be listening are aware of who Cameron is, but just by way of introduction, I want to explain that he's a professor of family studies at Fuller Theological Seminary in the School of Psychology. He arrived as a student in 1980, and he graduated in 1986, and since that time, has more or less been on our faculty ever since.
It's just
the fact.
I came and I never left.
Well, I'm really delighted that we have this conversation, and Fuller has been an endless beneficiary of Cameron's wisdom and collegiality and insight that has been about the marriage in many ways of theology and psychology in family studies, but really as Christian disciples. And the book that we're going to be primarily focusing on today is a book entitled What Love Does and Why It Matters. This is a recent book by Cameron, and it's subtitled Romance, Relationships, and 1 Corinthians 13. So before we jump into that book, Cameron, just tell us a little bit about your own spiritual background. And since this book is about love, tell us about some early, profound, formative experience of love that you think shaped you.
In a way that won't embarrass anybody?
Or might embarrass somebody.
My own spiritual background is that I did not grow up in the church. My parents were not Christians. My first exposure to anything related to the gospel was when we would go to visit my grandparents who lived in Stockton. I grew up in the Bay Area. And my grandfather and my grandmother, my mother's parents, were both very devout people in their own way. They had lived in China before coming to the United States. My grandfather was a university professor, so I pull a little bit from that side of the family in terms of interests and inclination. Growing up in a fairly traditional Chinese family, and it's traditional in some ways and not so traditional in others. My father was born here. My mother was an immigrant. She came over when she was in her teen years. And so what you see of family relationships and of love and so forth across the generations and around you and the surrounding culture and so forth, without having, as is the case in families such as our own, traditional in orientation, you don't really talk a lot about those kinds of things. And then wanting to come in to a place of seeing the possibility of being able to become a family therapist and work with couples and families and that kind of thing. At the point that I was thinking about that, I was not a Christian. I did not become a Christian until my very first day of college and was approached by a couple of young men from Campus Crusade with the Four Spiritual Law booklet and answered all the questions the right way. You know, if you could know and experience God more personally, would you be interested? Yes. Let's go through this booklet, pray the prayer at the end. Like, I had no idea what I was doing when I did
Amazing.
That. But that was, in some ways, the beginning of the journey.
Right.
And
right.
Fuller came only a few years after that.
Wow. So when that all unfolded, when in that history, then, did the actual love of God become an experience to you?
It still is.
Yes.
I mean, you know, I am by nature what some people would consider a person with an engineering temperament.
Uh-huh.
So I know some people who are probably more emotive in their love of God. For me, it's an appreciation of his beauty, glory, majesty, all those kinds of things. And I am still learning over mm-hmm. the many years what it really means mm-hmm. to love God.
Mm-hmm. What was it that gave you the instincts to want to pursue something related to family therapy and counseling and all of those things, even before your faith had grown? Was it out of
yeah.
the sense of your own family's circumstances?
Right. And that's why, you know, I don't want to say too much about that.
Sure.
Except to say that I grew up in an environment where what it meant to be married and to be married well was something that was still an open question for mm-hmm. me. And I could see the need for being able to reach out to people and to help them understand that. And again, at that time, since I wasn't a Christian, I didn't connect that with a sense of what that looks like in a congregational context and how people might have different kinds of questions related to that. That didn't come until later, but I'm at that place now, especially in my life and career, where I see more and more every year just how tremendous the need is and how much we just walk through our lives and take for granted what we have in our homes and in our relationships without getting past kind of the rule level that says, if you're a good Christian, you should do this and you shouldn't do that. But there's not much in the way of a transformed imagination with respect to the way the gospel reforms our perceptions and relationships.
So if you have a kind of engineering orientation, did you think
I'm going to have to live that down that forever
family,
now.
That family therapy was like getting in under the hood and adjusting some things in order to have a better operating engine? Or what was your what were your assumptions about what that would even mean?
Well, there were always, and I suppose there are a lot of folks who come into the field with that kind of a sense, you know, you're hoping that if you just learn the right ideas and techniques and so forth, it's really not all that difficult to go in and tinker with a few things and get people to talk to each other and have a better relationship.
Right.
And sometimes that works. I mean, we're generally talking about the folks that didn't need a whole lot of help to begin with.
Right.
But it's been, and to make sure that I keep the context, there was a point at which I had to make a decision, and that was when I was hired by Fuller, had to make a decision as to whether or not I was going to become licensed as a therapist. I had the training, I was doing the hours, but when I was hired by Fuller, I was trying to prepare a full course load in my first year. I had a baby at home. I lived 30 miles away because we couldn't afford to live in Pasadena. And so the one thing that I decided was expendable was the license. So I never actually got licensed to practice. And I actually have not regretted that because God's actually drawn me in different directions, which are much more ministry-related, much more church-related.
Right.
And so taking everything that I do and teach with respect to family and marriage relationships into the context of the church is kind of my wheelhouse. It's the way I think.
Right. Well, one of the things that is so interesting about this book, and again, the title is What Love Does and Why It Matters, is that it really reflects in a way that experience, because the assumptions of the book are that the things that you're describing are complex, they're subtle, they're multivalent, they come from all kinds of angles and dimensions of the individual, the dynamics of a couple, the dynamics of a family, a society, a culture. It's a complicated overlay of many different things. And part of what you're getting at, I think even in the title, is that your interest in love is about love in action, what it does, as opposed to what it is. You even say at the beginning of the book that you're not so much going to be concerned about really a definition, so much as you're going to be concerned about a kind of portrait or an action film about what it really looks like. How does it actually get performed?
Right.
Talk a little bit about that, because I think those things seem to me to have instinctive connections to particularly a Christian view of love as something that's been enacted by God toward the world and toward the people of God.
There's a few different ways to get at that. I mean, one very concrete way to get at that is to simply recognize that our English translations of what Paul actually says, it's more natural for us to translate that as love is patient, love is kind. And there's no good, easy way to translate into English the fact that Paul uses verbs throughout that passage in 1 Corinthians 13. So already we have a difference in terms of the way we think about that. But one of the reasons why I think it's important to keep it in that active mode and think about what love does rather than what love is that our language of what is tends to make things too static and tends to devolve into arguments about definition that take you out of the mode of saying, so what is the implication for, you know, the way that we comport ourselves either as individuals or as a community, and to always be thinking about love as an expression of the gospel embodied in the way that we actually live and relate to one another. So to the extent that keeping it as what love does rather than what love is, if we can get past the, well, I think love is this, and I think love is this, and do you have this quality, and do you have this quality, and that kind of thing, is not as helpful as being able to say, what would love have me do?
Right.
What would God have me do in this situation?
Right. I remember a number of years ago, Janet and I were doing some psychotherapy together as a couple, and one of the things that the therapist that we were working with gave us as an exercise was to write a list of 10 things that when the other person does them, we feel loved. Hmm. And it was a very, very simple exercise, and it was immediately apparent to both of us what we would put on our respective lists.
Right.
And of course, there were similarities in certain aspects, but there were a lot of things that were quite different about what we each received and were able to understand as love, but in every case, they were actions. And it was interesting that in that season of life, it became very important and amazingly, almost surprisingly life-giving to realize that if you let love be about those very particular things, that small though they were often very tiny gestures, but they were very meaningful gestures. And they, in a way, reset emotionally some of the other larger, more complicated things that we were actually dealing with.
Yeah.
That's part of what you're getting at.
Yeah. And I think it's important to say in the situation that you're describing, or I'll make an assumption here on, on my part, and that is along with the clearer understanding of what each of you would understand to be love in the relationship is also the willingness to want to do something, to express that love to each other, rather than trying to prove to each other, hey, I was right all along. See, I do in fact love you because it says right here that that's what the definition is.
Yes, exactly.
With that kind of thing. So you are already wanting to come halfway towards each other
in
terms of being able to express that. And the behavior itself unlocks then an interaction in which you experience what it is that you're expressing.
Right. You know, this book that focuses on 1 Corinthians 13, in a way, parallels an earlier book of yours on the Beatitudes. You're taking these biblical texts, sometimes imprisoned, I would say, in the liturgy or habitual life of the church. And you're trying to help us understand and feel and see and reimagine how they can help us see the world and each other in a different way, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
And I think that when you read this book, you feel the weight of somebody who has been for three decades working on issues of relationships in families and family systems and churches as well. And you're harvesting really things that it feels to me are part of that rich background that are related and inspired by 1 Corinthians 13. But was there some particular thing or cluster of particular things that motivated you to want to work on this text? Clearly, of all texts, it's the one that I've often said is imprisoned in a wedding ceremony. So it's often only left there and not really explored or developed in a wider way. But how did it become the case that you wanted to choose this particular text?
Well, that requires me to tell another family story.
Feel free.
But it was, as you say, the sense of it being imprisoned in wedding ceremonies or little keepsakes that you buy at the Christian bookstore, and I actually have one of those on my shelf in the office. I've done a number of weddings, and I always ask couples before the wedding if there's a particular text that they want me to center the homily on, and it's always one of two. It's either 1 Corinthians 13 or it's Genesis, you know, for this reason shall a man leave his father and mother and cleave to his wife. And so I'll build those into the homilies, but particularly when I do 1 Corinthians 13, because that's the most popular choice
by far.
I will preach it in such a way that this, okay, so this is what it's really going to mean. And here's what it's going to look like when you wake up in the morning and you're frustrated with each other and that kind of thing. The reality of it is that by the time the wedding ceremony is over and the whole context defines what we're doing as a wonderful romantic event and that kind of thing, and I love weddings and I love being there and the whole spirit of that. But frankly, I know that nobody's listening to what I'm saying. The interesting conversations that I've had is that some of the people who are sitting out there watching the wedding are struck by it, which I'm happy with. And they will come up to me afterwards and they'll say things like, wow, you know, my husband and I were sitting over there and we're looking at each other and saying like, how are we doing with this? That kind of thing. But the couple themselves are just waiting for that last, and now pronounce you husband and wife, and then ready to move on to the next thing. And it's the kind of conversation that needs to happen outside of the wedding ceremony itself. So that's what the book actually embodies, is this is what I would like to be able to communicate to you when you're ready to hear it.
Right. One of the things that is also interesting to me about the book is that you, in a way, unpack all the layers of, I suppose, clarity and distortion that mm-hmm. our culture, our iconography in culture
yeah.
suggests about what love is, how romance, what right. role romance has, what romance is in relationship to love. Mm-hmm. Just say a bit about that. I mean, what are some of the things that you think are the most distorting in our understanding of love? And then how does the romance theme in our culture particularly contribute to some of that?
Let me start with a couple of experiences that I've had in the last couple of years where I've had an opportunity to get together with groups of young adults, sometimes young professionals and so forth, in our congregation. And you know, they've asked me, so what do you want to speak about? I'm like, well, what do you want me to speak about? And let's talk about relationships. And so I've told them, okay, so here's what I want you to do, if it's as open-ended as that. I want you to tell the group what I do for a living. And I want you to say, if you had an opportunity to sit down with somebody who does that for a living and ask them any question you wanted about relationships, what would those questions be?
Great.
Gather that
idea.
Together. Send it to me, and I'll prepare my response around that. We'll just have some conversation. And those have been some of the most eye-opening and enriching conversations that I've had. And both the encouraging and the discouraging part of it is they're very willing to ask the questions, hard questions, but they feel like, in general, there's nowhere to go with the questions that they have. And they're questions about dating, sexuality. Why is it so hard to be single in the church? Why is it that, you know, it seems as if people are just waiting for us to get married, and yet we can't talk about this and we can't do that and all of those kinds of things? So I think people recognize that what in the book I refer to as the romance culture is really not the whole story. But in some ways, that culture is reinforced in so many different ways, whether it's through social media, whether it's through other kinds of media. And if we're not talking about this, and if we're running scared from it, then a lot of the people who are trying to make good decisions don't have anywhere to go other than their own imaginations to try to figure out what to do. Mm-hmm. So that's where I think it's important, even before, I mean, I spend the whole first half of the book trying to unpack some of that and to see whether or not, does this sound familiar to mm-hmm. you? You know, this way of thinking, you grew up watching Disney movies and the Disney princesses, and you love those movies still. What lesson did you learn from those? And how does that affect the way that you go into your dating relationships now? Like it or not, whether or not you actually expect some of these things to happen in your relationship, or you think that there's something wrong with you.
Right, right. Well, one of the things that I think is so helpful about your book is that you keep circling around these issues of sort of malformation, where it feels mm-hmm. like things have distorted. But then you keep throwing down, I think, the meaty side of what it is that Christian faith can actually provide as a vision of God, as a vision of mm-hmm. God's love, as a mm-hmm. vision of love that actually celebrates, rejoices, delights,
right.
but also a love that nurtures, encourages, changes, transforms, labors.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you really get a feeling of the vigor of what the task of love in the world is about.
Right.
What are some of the things, when you think about the conferences like the ones you just described that you've spoken at, and when people have been tracking with you in a way that has felt to you like they got a hold of the thing that is really going to be a lifeline towards something that's beyond mm-hmm. the cultural vision of love, what are the places that you would say people are most helped typically when you go into a conference with the kind of framework that you describe? Mm.
I think there's two things. And again, if we're talking about folks who have grown up as believers and say that they love God and, you know, believe in Jesus and all of that kind of thing, but have never been helped to understand how that faith actually works itself out in the decisions that they make with respect to what is prescribed to us by the romance culture, by the dating culture, you know, some of the things that I've had these conversations with college students and recent college graduates and so forth about going to college campuses and the whole culture around the ring by spring thing, which that whole idea just drives me crazy. And the students are aware of this. You know, there's this upper crust of people who, yeah, they make that choice and they get engaged before they graduate. They're the winners of the game, you know, that kind of thing. If they haven't had an opportunity to be in a place where their commitments and what they say they believe has really been brought to bear on stuff like that, then just the very idea that that's possible is an eye-opener already.
Right.
And it would take, you know, many more conversations to keep that along. But, you know, it's sort of like it opens up a door.
Right.
To be able to see things differently and to wonder what the possibilities might be.
Right. What are the triggers around things like, especially I'm thinking of online dating and internet social media relationships. Mm. How are those things affecting, do you think, the understanding or expectations around relationships and love and intimacy?
That's a very, very big question. And in answering that question, I have to start by addressing my social location, right? I am what you would call a digital immigrant rather than a digital native. And a digital native is probably going to answer that question a lot differently.
Right.
Because I use social media, but that's exactly the difference. I use social media. I don't live social media. So from that perspective, as somebody who comes at social media in that regard, part of my concern is, I mean, there's the psychological side of it in terms of what is it that gets us hooked on social media to begin with and to attach too much of our own sense of self-worth to that in terms of how many likes and follows and so forth am I getting. There's the question of image management in terms of whether or not there is some compulsion to represent yourself in an ideal way that looks like you have a more interesting life than perhaps you really do, especially as you're comparing yourself to other people and their self-presentations and how you evaluate yourself according to that. And then there's the question, I mean, the big question with people who are in adolescence and are still learning about some of these kinds of things as to what the boundaries are, if you really understand what never goes away once you post it online. And how do you learn the wisdom to know what is and isn't a good idea in that regard until you've been hurt by it? So part of it is not just, okay, so can we create the rules that would make this safe for people? But what is it that people are already learning about love and relationships and so forth from the models that they have in their lives so that people who may understand a little bit more about what the boundaries could be or should be with the use of social media are actually going to be authoritative voices in people's lives?
I'm Mark Labberton. You're listening to Conversing, a production of Fuller Studio. It's such a shifting hookup culture in general that exists. And for young adults and older adults, but certainly for young adults, the immediacy, the quick, rapid fireness of it all is itself a counterpoint to anything like simply a committed friendship, a long-term relationship of care or compassion or any of those things. It's almost like it's playing with our experience of time and time in relationship to relationships, which is a big theme. I mean, you can't read 1 Corinthians 13 without realizing that it's describing something over time. It's not a moment, and it's certainly not a short moment. It's a long moment, a long season, a chapter, a whole book.
It sort of makes me wonder what Paul might have said were he to see the culture that we have now.
Yes.
With the kind of technology that we have and the way that it affects our relationships and so on. I think you're right. It does change our sense of time and immediacy. It changes our expectations with respect to what intimacy actually looks like, especially when, you know, you might post something, you might tweet something that in and of itself might have been considered something only for a face-to-face conversation earlier on. And then, you know, because it has an audience and it's the audience that you are actually wanting, that's where you get that sense of, okay, so this is where I count, this is where I matter, is because I have that audience. I know if people, for example, have to divide up their social world into the people that they communicate to on a general basis because, you know, you share these platforms on social media versus the people that you text versus the people that you'll actually talk to on the phone versus the people that you'll actually talk to face-to-face. And it just makes me wonder, and I don't have any direct data for this, but it just makes me wonder to what extent, if the majority of our communication is more on that end of things, do we lose the ability to really have that intimate face-to-face conversation? Because this is where those long-term relationships are really going to be built.
Right, right. You know, one of the things that is striking to me about the take that you have on love in this book is that you would want to talk about love in marriage or family, but you would also see that as being really an expression of a broader love, which is the love of God in Christ, but the love that we then offer back as a disciple. And it's placing family, marriage, romance, et cetera, in the broader context of what it means to be a person who's caught up in the love of God.
Right.
And this is, again, where it seems to me that one of the great opportunities and challenges of our current moment is to try to say that broader discipleship has often not happened in people's lives.
Yeah.
We've obviously been bombarded by countless messages of a completely other kind.
Right.
So what does it take to nurture a discipleship that lands in the kind of love that you're describing here? Mm-hmm. What is that journey about?
Mm-hmm. One of the important pieces that has to be included in there is what's the role of the Christian community? And especially thinking about the fact that what Paul was writing, he was not writing to individuals. He wasn't writing to married couples or, you know, people in dating relationships or some such thing. He was writing to a church, and a very troubled church is that, and trying to transform their imagination. You know, what are you really about? Where are we missing the boat in terms of what it is that you say you believe and how you actually treat one another? And part of the issue, and you know, I can illustrate this with the fact that whenever I do a wedding ceremony, for example, after I speak to the couple about their relationship and what 1 Corinthians 13 really means in that context, I think for myself, the ceremony isn't over until I turn to the rest of the congregation and tell them what their role is.
Right.
That if you are friends and you are family, you know, you have to do your job. And if you really love these people and you're here and you're witnessing them making these vows, then you have to do the kind of thing that, for example, very concretely, if one of them comes to you later on complaining about the other person and wants you to take their side, your responsibility is not to take sides. Your responsibility is not to side with this individual or that individual. Your responsibility is to side with the relationship. And without that, all we have are, here's some recommendations for people who want to do a better job in their romantic relationships of loving one another. So discipleship has the personal commitment component to it, but who holds the vision? There needs to be, within the congregation as a whole, an understanding of, well, why is it that we care about married couples to begin with? What are we doing when we actually perform a wedding? If we're going to do marriage ministry, what is that going to be grounded in? And is this just going to be a special interest thing where if you happen to be married, maybe you might be interested in, y'all come? Or is this about, okay, this is what we believe about everyone who goes by the name of Christian, who considers themselves to be a follower of Christ. What does love look like in your relationship? If you happen to be married, now here's what it might actually look like in your relationship specifically.
I think that take is actually very life-giving, especially in contexts where you have a significant number of single adults of all different ages.
Absolutely.
Who can often feel in these sorts of conversations like nothing is really pertinent to them. In fact, they're loudly and fairly clearly, if not explicitly, excluded. That's often the experience.
Right.
Whereas I think one of the things that comes when you understand the whole texture of this is really about a discipleship that involves responding to the love of God and offering the love of God, in which there's many, many manifestations of which, as you say, marriage and family are some expressions, but not the only or even necessarily always the primary ones.
Right.
One of the things about the word incarnation is obviously a sense that this has to really involve not just action, but it therefore involves our body. It involves really our physicality. We love tangibly. I remember being struck by that very vividly when we had our first child, and over the first year, suddenly just becoming aware of how much of our life was about the body of our child in a way that my body had never gotten that attention. Yeah. No other body had ever gotten this amount of attention. I was now completely immersed in the body of my baby, right? Because there's so much life that you can only give, nurture, encourage in that way, right? And it has often been a goad to me to realize just in friendship, in action, in normal, ordinary relationships, and in the context of marriage and family, that there's just such a physicality, an actual demonstration of something, a giving and a receiving that has to be physical as well as active. Do you want to comment on that?
Sure. I mean, to bring the example of having a child into it is perfect for that. I mean, children in particular need that kind of care. You can't talk to your child about love. You can't convince them that you love them. They learn that, they know that by the way you care for them, by the way that you hold for them, by the way that you meet their needs. And, you know, so my own experience of becoming a dad is realizing what it is that holding your child brings out of you that you didn't even know was there before. How much you can care for somebody, how irritated somebody can make you. You think your spouse makes you irritated, and that's not even half of what a child can do, but it's the flip side of this deep emotional connection that we have with our children that begins with that kind of physicality, with the holding, with the cuddling, and all of that.
Yeah. Our boys were adopted, and that meant that from the beginning, and we got each of them the day after they were born, that I was able to share equally in the nighttime feedings, which I have to say I was thrilled about.
Yeah.
And I loved doing that. I loved not the moment necessarily of getting out from under the warm covering,
yes,
but
of
I
course.
Definitely loved the chance to be with them in that way.
Yeah.
And it felt even then like it was just a nanosecond. It was just going to last for such a short period of time.
Yeah.
And now they're in their 20s and long gone from that stage. But there is a residue of physical connectedness.
Yeah.
And I think the same thing is true of almost any really close relationship, not because every relationship is a physical relationship, obviously, but because every relationship has a physicality about it, of what it's like. And I guess the reason I'm mentioning this is that so much of the way that life is unfolding these days feels as though it's virtual and only visual.
Yeah.
It's not actually that we're even physically present in the same space. We're not thinking about how we live in the texture of ordinary bodied places because so much contact now happens in a disembodied way.
Right.
And I'm struck that it feels to me like it's going to continue to grow in the negative ways that it affects our ability to be able to be physically present and to realize that it really does require active physical presence often to demonstrate love.
Yeah, and I think some of that has to do with, you know, even okay, so we could think about the children and having kids and the physicality in terms of the cuddling and the holding and all that reciprocity, but also what it is about face-to-face interaction where you are learning to respond to each other's gestures, facial cues, tone of voice, all of which is missing in the electronic virtual communication, so much so that, you know, I've read stories about how it is with some kids, that again, some digital natives who are being given digital devices from the moment that they can hold them as what some people would call a shut-up toy, right? You can distract a child from being whiny or something by giving them your iPad or your phone or something like that. And there are some kids who are growing up that when they hear a voice or when they're being spoken to, instead of making eye contact with the person that's speaking to them, their immediate reaction is to look down as if there was going to be a screen in front of them. This is where the communication is coming from. We're not going to know for many years yet what the consequences of that might actually be, but I think there's enough indication already that our normal flow of face-to-face interaction has been disrupted, especially if we start using digital devices from a very early age.
Right. When you think about the challenges of our society, where right now it feels to me that on a broader level, I would say we're having a very difficult time as a nation loving, to say the least, and where the issues of politics and race and gender are so evidently demonstrating that we're not very good at love, whether it's the Me Too campaign, whether it has to do with all the things that are going on in the issues of relationship to women and the abuse of women in the workplace and elsewhere, whether we're thinking about the racial hostilities and the readiness to do battle over those things, to exclude rather than love immigrants, often even dreamers. Those are flashpoints of an unwillingness or an incapacity to love, to let something else trump love, which could be something like a certain vision of a nation or a certain kind of understanding of what the law is for or what our identity is composed of, sure, or what citizenship means, all those varieties of things. I'm just curious, when you take the theme of what love does and why it matters, and you move from the personal and the interpersonal to a more systemic and even national vision of that, mm-hmm, can we talk meaningfully about love at that level? Or is that really an abstraction that almost rips it from any relevance, that it really can only be finally interpersonal if you're really talking about love?
No, I mean, love is going to be interpersonal at some level no matter what. And I'm hoping that it's going to be more than that. The question that I have, given the scope of the way that you asked it, is Paul's vision of love is of the love of God through Jesus Christ for the church, and how then people should respond in their relationships to one another, with another implication of how then Christians should respond to the world in terms of love. But he doesn't say anything about how the world should respond to Christians. So we already have a great deal of work to do within the church in terms of how we love one another and how we love others. But whether or not love as it's taught scripturally can be an organizing idea, principle, vision, or anything for anyone outside the church is a big open question.
To say the least, yeah. I think of Jesus' teaching in Matthew 6 about the fact that it's not a big deal if we love those who love us, but whether we love those who don't love us, who aren't like us, and who may even be our enemies. And if that's the gold standard, that is love of enemies, then I think the implication of that is that we serve an enemy-loving God, and that that's the ultimate standard of why the gospel is the gospel, because it was while we were yet enemies or sinners that Christ died for us, right? Mm-hmm. So I think that one of the great challenges from my point of view that I found as a theme in this book was the need for our love capacity to be infused by resources that are from beyond us, which is really the character of God's love and grace.
Right.
But then so often in the culture of the church, which is a culture often shaped by anxiety and fear, we've turned away from simply the other, let alone the enemy.
Right.
And then we don't see the church as a place that grooms our capacity for generosity of love, imagination, and purpose. So if you were to be king of the forest and you could establish in churches the kind of thing that would foster that kind of love to move toward not just those that are in our intimate circle, family, friends, and church, but toward the other and toward the enemy. What does 1 Corinthians 13 teach us about that?
I think there's a great deal in 1 Corinthians 13 that is already addressing the conflicts within the church in Corinth where people may have experienced each other as enemies to begin with. If we're moving outwards from there, whether we're talking about Matthew 6 or other texts, I think I would couch the love of enemies in an even larger principle. I would take the love of enemies as a more specific example of an even larger thing in terms of within the context of, say, an honor-shame culture, of being able to even see and notice.
Right.
I think back to a sermon that you gave a few years ago about the woman with the bleeding, who reached out and touched Jesus, and the gift that he gave to her was not just a matter of healing, it was a matter of seeing.
Yes.
And there are any number of people in our lives, whether they're in our communities or in our congregations, and sometimes even within our own families, that we don't hate per se. They're not enemies in our typical sense of the word, but we don't see them.
Yes.
And because we don't see them, we don't love them.
Right, right. I'm inspired by this book, Cameron, and I'm really grateful for the time that you've taken to write it, and really hope that it gets a great readership, because it seems to me that anything that can provoke and push and encourage and invite us to love God and know God's love more deeply is desperately needed. And the evidence of a church that is steeped in what you're describing, I think, would look very different than a lot of the churches that we see around us. Love manifests itself in a lot of different ways, and Jesus' teaching clearly undergirds that in different directions. And one of the themes that I know you've been thinking about recently is peacemaking, and you're going to be giving a set of lectures in 2018 on the theme of Christian therapists as peacemakers. So talk to us about peacemaking and love, and then I have a question I want to ask you following that.
Okay. Both of those themes tie nicely together in as much as they both represent They're different texts, based on different texts, of course. The peacemaking emphasis comes out of Jesus' Beatitudes at the beginning of the Sermon on the Mount, and the book on love comes out of 1 Corinthians 13. But they both represent texts that, for one reason or another, in my own life and ministry, I've had to spend a lot of time wrestling with and trying to understand, what does this say to all of us, the entire church, to all of believers, with respect to our discipleship and how we envision what we do. So the Beatitudes have become, for me, kind of the touchstone for teaching integration here at Fuller to our students who are planning to be family therapists. Because again, to the extent that a lot of, we have students that are from such different backgrounds in terms of their theology training, how long they've been Christians and that kind of thing. And part of what I've wanted over time is some coherent way of being able to draw together the questions of, so what is it going to mean for me to be a therapist? But what does it have to do with who I am as a Christian, and why should that matter? Wouldn't it be enough that I would just learn the right way to do therapy and then pray for my clients before I go into the room? So for me, the idea of peacemaking and the way that I teach it with respect to integration to our students has to do with what we call the clinical virtues. So you have peacemaking as the motif for understanding your vocation, and then inside of that, four clinical virtues that we talk about, both from Scripture and what they would mean in your interaction with clients: hope, humility, compassion, and Sabbath rest.
So if you were to take the word peacemaking in the light of the Beatitude and connect it to 1 Corinthians 13's theme of love, is peacemaking a necessary part of love, or is it a particular thing to a therapist or to a person that's exercising that kind of vocation?
Yeah, I'm not sure that I would want to try to couch one under the other, whether peacemaking is part of love or love is a part of peacemaking or whatever. When I think of peacemaking, it's not conflict resolution or some such thing. I think of peacemaking in terms of, what does it mean to understand yourself as someone who has the vocation of bringing foretastes of God's kingdom and shalom into the world, in everything that you do and in all of your relationships? And sometimes what I've asked people to do when I do this as part of a marriage seminar, for example, is to think back to the story of creation and to think about how God, at the end of each day, again, depending on how you read the text, but at the end of each day, is able to look at what he has created and to say that it is good. What would it take for God to look at your relationship right now and to say that it is good, with that same sense of, this is something that God can really give honor to? That's going to take love to
that
be able to do
take
that.
Take love.
Yeah.
Do you think that there's things about peacemaking that are unique to marriage that are so distinct that they belong only uniquely to marriage? Or are there things that you think the peacemaking in marriage experiences that could actually become useful or are meant to be useful in a brighter and broader way?
I think I would probably reframe that in terms of not saying that there is necessarily something unique to peacemaking in marriage, but there is something unique to marriage relationships, and therefore the expression of peacemaking may take a particular form related to that. So just as we were discussing earlier about, you know, how unique is the relationship that you have with your baby, for example, and how unique is the relationship that you have with your spouse, how is it that this person can pull certain emotional experiences out of you that other people wouldn't? The way in which we can be perfectly reasonable outside of the home with other people who you would think, just by virtue of what was being said, were pushing the same buttons, but your spouse in those conversations draws a different reaction and everybody's confused about where that is. So, you know, you brought out the theme of embodiment earlier on. Part of the embodiment of peacemaking is to be able to not just think of love as some abstract notion, and not to think of love as just a cognitive decision that we make in obedience to Scripture that doesn't have anything to do with emotion. Emotion is very much a part of who we are. That's inescapable. Emotion is very much a part of our marriage relationships, and that's much of what we struggle with in those relationships. And so peacemaking has to do intrinsically in marriage with being able to enact love in the face of these emotions that would draw us in a different direction. And in order to do that, we have to at least recognize where it is that we're struggling with those emotional experiences as we attempt to be obedient.
That's a magnificent picture of what integration involves. So I'm very much looking forward to those lectures.
Thank you.
Thank you for your work, and thank you very much for this conversation.
Thank you again for the opportunity.
You've been listening to a production of Fuller Studio. Fuller Studio provides articles, podcasts, videos, and other resources for a deeply formed spiritual life. Subscribe on your favorite podcast app or visit us at fuller.edu/studio.